Welcome to the stand-up. Today is an extremely special episode. We have Adam Yunus, we have Nolan E-I-E-I-O, and of course we have the master vibe coder, Tej.
What up?
Anyways, sorry. For those that do not know E-I-E-I-O, you probably know him through some of his epic games, including 1 million checkboxes. And I forget if it's a million chessboards. I forget the exact name. What was it again?
Yeah, 1 million chessboards. Yeah, yeah.
1 million chessboards. I just couldn't believe it in my head, but it is truly 1 million chessboards. And then also, Adam, if you remember the tower, he is the Pixel King Adam, making insignia the game. I believe it is wishlistable and demoable at this point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got to go check it out on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
Sign up or you're a loser.
Yeah. All right. Wishlist insignia on Steam if you're not a broke boy, right? Wasn't that the song?
That was the song. So this is a very special episode because this is going to be more towards game development, but we don't have our signature game developer, Casey, with us today. Instead, we're going to be talking about probably more of the lifestyle and the choices of what it takes to do more of the indie style gaming and what we're building. And I'd actually first like to start with Nolan. Because fun fact about Nolan is he used to be a Jane Street boy.
That's right.
If you do not know this, Jane Street is a big fan of OCaml. So why are your games not written in OCaml?
Thank you. Finally asking the real questions.
Thank you.
I'm glad we're hitting hard at the beginning.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is real journalism.
This is journalism. You know, I think this is the first time that anyone's asked me that, which might shock you.
Yes, that does not shock me at all, but unfortunately.
Honestly, I think the answer
is one of the few people that know what OCaml is. So it actually...
Hey, I wrote 1/10 of a game engine in OCaml Prime, I'll have you know. Anyways, let's let Nolan talk.
No, so I think the answer here is kind of boring, to be honest. Like, the tooling that Jane Street has for writing OCaml is just phenomenal. Like, it's so fun to write OCaml there. And at least, like, while I was there, writing it outside of the firm was just, like, way less fun than writing it there. I think that's changed a lot. I mean, TJ, I don't know. Like, you've definitely written OCaml more recently than me. You're having a good time. You're doing some vibing, right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
Maybe agents fix this. Maybe the tooling's just gotten better. But that was most of it.
Tooling is
I do
the,
miss it, though.
Yeah, that's the ever... I don't know, the ever-present OCaml problem of adoption is just like, this compiled sometimes, but then I can't get it to work on someone else's machine, and I don't understand because this language should be easy to compile, but whatever. We're not going to rant about OCaml, but we can have you just come on stream sometime. We'll hang out and write some OCaml together. It would be fun.
That'd be sick.
Yeah.
I miss OCaml a lot.
Nice. We're going to make it the number one game dev. We're going to take down Unity.
Press down! What happened?
I don't know. Did you push?
On a Friday? Never!
How are we gonna figure this out? How are we gonna figure this out?
Did I just hear prods down? Do you guys need the wheel?
NeoVim config!
That makes sense.
I'm gonna spend a couple hours refactoring.
Oh, need the plugins!
Don't guess where your issues are. You can see exactly where they are happening with Sentry. Get all the context you need to debug any problem because code breaks, so fix it faster with Sentry.
That's right, yeah. Unity and OCaml, the two, yeah.
They've been a competitor since day one, and that's really like the field that OCaml's trying to just really...
We're going to
get wait, so Adam, you use Unity. Why do you not use OCaml?
Great question.
Good question.
Honestly, I didn't know about OCaml until I met TJ, so...
That's unfortunately also a common phrase.
I've only had a year.
Yeah. We'll give him some more time. We'll give him some more time.
Don't
get him distracted right now. He needs to finish Insignia.
That's the problem.
Just a quick, hey, we're in the day of agents, TJ. He can just do a quick rewrite. OCaml, just, hey, no mistakes. Translate it all. Boom. OCaml.
In games, though, you have to say make it fun. Not just make it secure.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. That's the key feature for
games. Well, it's like make a few mistakes.
Make it secure, no hacking.
Make a few mistakes,
but like fun, right? Like fun little, like speed running. Yeah, speed run bugs. Yeah.
Yes.
Make sure it's exploitable.
Make three subtle exploitable speed running glitches that will consume some people's entire life.
Or at least like all of their like teens and 20s.
Yes, right.
Yeah, right. Like we can, you know, by when they're 30, they can, yeah,
they'll move on, right? We don't want to make such an addictive one that they continue to speed run well into their late 30s. That would be a little too much, probably.
Please.
Also, they
ensure.
Need to buy the sequel, the refresh that we nostalgia drop when they hit 30. So we don't want to leave too many. You know, that's part of the problem there.
Just all enough right. for a summoning soul video.
Now we're talking.
That's the key. By the way, okay, since we're on this topic, did you know that Fortnite's rocket writing was also an accidental exploit?
Really?
So if you don't know, really? If you shoot a rocket, someone else can jump and land on the rocket and ride it mm-hmm. until it explodes or hits an object. And this was just a thing you could do. And Epic never intentionally put that in the game. They only accidentally discovered it was a thing later on.
Wow. Prime knows that because he used to be a Fortnite streamer.
True. I used to be a Fortnite streamer.
That was how we got started.
Look at you now.
No, you guys were supposed to not say anything for longer. I was hoping that would be like a 15-second pause.
Just pause.
I know. Can we zoom in on Nolan's face? Because he just goes, hmm. He just kind of
just processing. Yeah.
Mouth.
I'd like to exit this interview.
All right. Let's actually get to some real questions. So I have to know, because I think a lot of people want to know this. Where did E-I-E-I-O come from, other than the childhood old McDonald's song?
Okay, so... It was my sister's first word, and when...
Is E-I-E-I-O?
That's right. It was the first, like, intelligible thing that she said, which, I don't know, maybe that tells you something about my sister. That's for you to decide.
Okay.
And when I was, like, 13 or 14, I just chose it as a name for the Team Liquid StarCraft forums. Y'all know Team Liquid?
Sick.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a good
I've
era,
been...
too. That was a good
yeah,
era.
No, that was,
StarCraft
I mean,
1.
That was, yeah. I mean, I had so much fun. I was like, you know, staying up all night watching StarCraft in Korea. I have like a little sign up here. You can barely see, but it has like a little blue line at the top. That's from going to a professional StarCraft game a couple of years ago in Seoul. But I picked the name there. And then eventually I like started writing mostly about Dota, not StarCraft.
Oh,
like,
I didn't know that.
Site. Yeah. And it wasn't, I mean, this is like right before esports became like big money, right? So it was still a little bit more DIY.
Pre-international?
No, this was like the first couple of internationals. So, you know, whatever. Things were taking off, but they weren't where they were now. Twitch wasn't in the same spot.
Yeah.
But the point is that I have, like, the first time that I made internet friends was via Team Liquid, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I have a bunch of people that I know from the forums, from writing stuff, just from, like, posting. You know, I have tens of thousands of posts there. And... So then when I started making games, it wasn't really something I was planning to do for that long. The thinking was like, I hadn't been coding. I'd been managing. So I was like, I'm going to make some games to kind of remember how to code, and then I'll go like start a startup or something. And so I picked the name just because I was like, well, this is what my internet friends know me as. And like, it doesn't matter that much. Mm-hmm. Probably if I could like go back in time, I would maybe think a little bit harder about it. But that is the origin story.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, Arnold was always told that he needed to change his last name because it was too hard. His Schnitzel is his example that he would give that everyone would say. But now his name is iconic. It's the thing you say when you know, Schwarzenegger's just like, that's the word. That is the that is the man. And so you can be, you know, E-I-E-I-O. When I see an article with E-I-E-I-O in it.
You think manly. You think Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Like, this is
right.
Arnold
the connection instantly.
Yeah, instantaneously.
Governor
Adam,
material.
Obviously, follow-up question. Why Adam C. Eunice? This big question here.
Well, you know, it's just a name that stuck, you know, from birth. couldn't shake it, you know. I have like a couple gamer tags, but they were never anything that anybody else called me by, and so it was never like I never felt comfortable enough really sticking to one, and now I just use them to safely play online and not be recognized.
Why the C? Like, why are you Adam C. Eunice?
Honestly, John C. Reilly, I'm a huge fan of him.
I was like, that's crazy. That's
it's the middle initial. The middle
I
initial makes
that
him.
Way yeah. too quickly. I was like, oh, okay, reasonable.
I was like, we do have a lot of refer activities, so that makes sense.
No, it was just, I think it was just the Twitter handle that I picked. And I'm not going to tell the true story, but I think that's just what happened. I just picked a Twitter handle and every
what
handle after that.
It's offline. Josh, don't cut this. Well, what?
Although I think it was like, I think it was a decision that I thought I made in an original thought, but yeah. I realized like a month later that a guy that I went to uni with also had C in his like middle initial and also used it everywhere. And I think I just went, oh yeah, that's my name. And I mean, it is my name, but but I think adding the C was him. I think he did that. And I just, yeah.
It does kind of make you feel very distinguished, I feel like. I think so too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mine was because my parents told me you can't pick an online name that you would get recognized by, that you would like, you know, say that you would dox yourself. So instead of TJ DeVries, I picked Tej DV because I was really far away from that. And then now my job is to get recognized on the internet. So take that, mom and dad. No, they actually like that I make videos. There's a decent chance my dad will watch this and say, like, you're so stupid. Why do you keep
bringing that up?
Yeah. This dumb joke? So, hey, Dad, if you're seeing this.
It took me forever to realize that it was TJ. Like, in my head, you were just Tej for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, like, what a lot of people call me Tej. So that I was like, that works. But guess my actual first name. Do you guys, Prime, do you even know?
Obviously, it's Telescopic Johnson.
Telescopic Johnson. Actually, that's so funny because a lot of people think that that's real still, which is insane. I made a plugin called Telescope for NeoVim, and like a lot of people, I think, were like, I just told them, like, yeah, I named it after myself after we started this meme of calling me Telescope Johnson. I was like, that's crazy. Your parents named you that? I was like, yeah, that's why I go by Tej, though. Oh, man.
Your name's Timothy, right? Timothy James?
Joel.
Timothy Joel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The full docs.
Yeah, yeah, full docs. I think it's probably out there. I don't think it's super hard to figure out. I'm pretty sure, like, you can find it with my social security number somewhere, I'm sure.
Yeah, what was your social?
Yeah, so that's... I wish I still had my beep, dude. I lost my Go XLR, bro.
Yeah,
I can't do my beep anymore. But... yes. So anyways, enough about my username.
Hold on. We do have to go back to that. When Nolan said, I didn't know your name was Tej. It was like Tej being Clark Kent and then pulling off the glasses and being Superman. It's just like, oh, Tej.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different guy.
Completely different guy there. Anyways, all right. Well, I have plenty more questions, but TJ, would you like to maybe direct us into a more serious?
Well, I can't believe you stole my OKMO question because obviously I was gonna ask that part. But I mean,
I don't see your name on it. Oh, like, look at it. I don't see your name on it. I'm looking right now.
It has OKMO in the question. That's mine. no, I was interested. So you guys mentioned offline, not part. You know, before we recorded, just Nolan, some of how like you got introduced to making games, and part of that was through Adam, which is part of the fun of like we wanted to have you both on at the same time. So I thought maybe you could talk about that a little bit and just give a little bit of that backstory and just so you know, so the listeners out there could hear that side too.
Yeah, like backstory to like how I started making games, or like
and any complaints about Adam and how he teaches A-Sprite. You can throw that in there if you need
both of those.
Let's see. So I started making games maybe like three years ago, almost exactly 3 years ago. And originally, like, this was not really a thing that I was planning to do for particularly long. It was mostly a way to get back to coding. I love games. I played tons of games my whole life, right? I used to write about games. And started making games, like, really small games in, like, Godot. I think, like, one bit of advice that you see a ton on the internet. I think it's really hard to give good advice about game development. But one, I think, very broadly applicable, often repeated bit of advice is just make a ton of games, right? Like, make, you know, don't, like, the classic mistake is that somebody makes an MMO that takes them 4 years and nobody plays it and, you know, they learn so much along the way. So I was making these tiny little games in Godot and found Adam stuff because I was I like made all of this pixel art and it all looks terrible. And I was like, so like, there's this weird thing when you're bad at something where you don't understand why, like you don't even have the like faculties to understand why it's bad. You're just kind of like looking at it and you're like, this is terrible. And I don't know the first step towards fixing it. And I never got good at pixel art. I ended up kind of moving away from making more typical games into the weird stuff that I do now. But one thing that I remember really enjoying about Adam's channel, and sorry, Adam, to compliment you live, is right. I think a lot of the stuff that you see on YouTube about making games is super edutainment-y, right? Like, the audience of people that kind of want to imagine themselves as game developers is much larger than the set of people that actually have the time to sink into making a lot of games. Mm-hmm. And I think also probably the audience of people that wants to talk about games is larger than the audience of people that actually makes games and can talk about those in a compelling way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think early on I was watching all this other content, right? And I would watch this video and I'd be feeling like I was learning a lot. And then I'd try to think about, like, what did I actually learn from this? And the answer is like nothing, right? Like nothing applicable to making stuff. But when you watch people that are actually doing the work and talking about their decisions, I think you learn a lot more there.
Mm-hmm.
So that is how I ended up finding Adam's work. And I made slightly better pixel art, learned things like your pixels should be the same size and to use a consistent color palette and other dead simple things that I think are in literally my first blog on the site. Yeah, that's the background. And I think no one played any of the games that I made in that era. Not literally nobody, but like, mm-hmm. like I got like 100 players for my second game and I was like, oh, this is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because that's also basically the way that I found Adam. Was I was just playing around with making some games, just like the concept of making a game. And then I found Adam's channel and I also really liked the art. And then me and Prime somehow found ourselves in a scenario where Cursor was like, yeah, you guys can make a video game. Go ahead, do it in a water tower.
Yeah.
Just put the game in the bag, bro. And I was like, well, I don't know what to do. And we were both like, I don't know, we should. And I was like, well, the coolest person I know that makes art for games and makes games is Adam. I don't know him at all. I've only watched his YouTube videos. And he happened to be in the U.S. Since when, Adam?
That was a year ago today, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
That was literally what? Today, a year ago.
No! Yeah. 1 year
ago. Oh, yeah, yeah. I was right in this area. Oh, yeah.
No, that's crazy.
That's cool.
Yeah, I was in San Francisco for GDC, and you guys just reached out, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna be around, and I hadn't been in the U.S. since 2011. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it was like, okay, well, do you want to fly down and make a game in a water tower with us? We're doing a 24-hour stream, and that's how the friendship started, which was awesome. So. Can second Adam being really good at making YouTube videos. If you guys aren't following him, you definitely should.
And he makes really good pixel art. It's addictive to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very true. Very true. He's the pixel king. Okay, so then, Nolan, so you were starting off, you found some stuff there, and then, like, how did you kind of transition out of, like, making some more, like, Godot-based stuff into, like, making crazier things?
Yeah. So do y'all know what the Recurse Center is? Feels like something you might know about.
I don't think so.
No, okay. This is going to sound like almost like an ad. I swear it's not. So early, like middle of that year, I went to this place called the Recurse Center, which is like a thing in Brooklyn that's kind of like a writer's retreat, but for programming.
Oh,
like
cool.
You show up for like 6 or 12 weeks. It's free. They like make money with like placing people in jobs or something. It doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is like you're in this room with other people that think it would be fun to program for 6 or 12 weeks on stuff that isn't for their job. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd known about it for a while. It's like 20 minutes for me. But I was there and I started kind of experimenting with like doing weirder things. I remember the first thing that I did that was stranger was, do you know the OpenSearch spec?
No.
No. This is okay. So, you know, like in Chrome, if you type in like a website URL and you hit tab.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it like lets you search that website directly, right?
Yep.
So like you need a spec for that. Like the browser, like how does the browser know what endpoint to hit in order to like search that website? OpenSearch is that spec. It's just an XML document you throw. You mention it in like the head of your index file. And yeah, no, I mean, it's old, right? There's also like 14 things called OpenSearch, but this is the OpenSearch search spec. So I happen to know, or I'd kind of like remembered that there's this extension to the spec that lets you offer search suggestions. Mm. So like you can offer an alternative endpoint and you like hit that endpoint and the endpoint returns back like suggestions for what you might be searching for, which makes mm-hmm. a lot of sense, right?
Did you make a dungeon crawler?
I didn't make a dungeon crawler. But I was like, you know what, like all you need for a game is like you're typing or like you have some input mechanism and some output right. mechanism and this works, right? Like you type a character, it hits this endpoint, the endpoint returns suggestions, the suggestions are automatically displayed in the browser, mm-hmm. like you can make a game there. And so I made Wordle, which I called Wardle, not knowing that that is Josh Wardle, who created Wardle's last name. and then like met him like a year later, and dude, that was funny. But so I made that, and I was like in this environment where instead of just kind of making it and shipping it off into the void, there are all these like nerds around who are like, wait, this is kind of funny. Mm-hmm. This is compelling. And someone posted on Hacker News. It's the first time that I got on Hacker News. And I think like that is how I started kind of narrowing in on like, oh, I like it's funny to make computers do weird things. It's funny to make jokes. Mm-hmm. And so I started noticing, like I went back and I made some more traditional games while I was there. And I remember the last thing that I made, it was like a tiny little Vampire Survivors clone.
Oh, nice.
Like, you know, people were like doing all sorts of things like that, right? Because Vampire mm-hmm. Survivors had just popped off.
Yeah.
And I was showing it at this gameplay test. And people were giving me feedback, and I could, like, feel myself, because I'd made some more weird stuff by then.
Mm-hmm.
I could feel myself, like, not, like, being like, I don't want your feedback. Not because, like, it's not good feedback, but because, like, I don't want to make games like this. And, like, you're giving me advice on, like, a thing that, like, I wish I hadn't made. Because, mm-hmm. like, everyone around me, it was at the bar that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Had all of these, like, weird, interesting, experimental things. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not, like, I'm much better at that than I am at building, like, a beautiful, well-thought-out, you know, kind of within-genre game. So that's kind of where I think that was the thing that really pushed me towards getting weirder and weirder and weirder.
I do have to say, I thought it was the most programmer description of a game of all time was, well, you just have some inputs and then you have outputs. So it's like, that's a game. Yeah,
it is. So this is, I think about this a lot with like the stuff when I'm making a game that is running in another application. So like mm-hmm. that, or like I have like Flappy Bird running in Mac OS Finder or whatever.
Right.
That is how like the terms that I'm thinking of. You like find like a surprising way that an application gives you input and output. Like for example, in Mac Finder, I can query to determine that you have clicked on a file.
Right.
And like that is sufficient input, right? And then output can be renaming files.
Mm-hmm.
This is a terrible way to think about like real games that people want to play.
Yeah.
But it's a great way to invent games that you can write blog posts about that people are not read.
Which, hey, if that's a whole new genre of games, but it does work, and they are funny, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I think if that's all I did, I would get a little sick of it, but it's really fun sometimes.
Yeah.
Is there like do you ever have like a personal win condition for a game? Like, is it, oh, I need for the player to feel this, or is it more like a personal expression thing? Like, when do you know when something's finished?
Oh, that's a good question. And I would love to hear your answer to this as well. I think it depends a lot. For like the bigger multiplayer experimental stuff thing, I think it's kind of vibes. Like, I think a lot about like, how are people going to ruin this? And I want to be really confident that it's hard for people to ruin it, right? Because mm-hmm. that's just like, you kind of get one shot. And if like a bunch of people go to the website and it's just like slurs and porn or whatever, you know, depending on how people want to ruin something, it's just like not, it's just not fun.
That's very typical internet too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just happens, right? Like this, and this sucks, but if you don't do something about it, it is what people do. For kind of the smaller, like, the way I think about this is that I make games and then I also make things that aren't really games. Like the Wordle thing, no one's gonna play that. That exists so that I can write the blog about it, right? And mm-hmm. teach people something interesting in this weird mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, I think it's kind of when there are no more problems left to solve. Like, I get to a point where I'm like, this technology is not meant to run a game. Like, it's, you know, macOS, I pushed macOS Finder to 4 frames a second. I had to add, like, double buffering to it. It was a lot of work. And, like, this is, like, where we call it. I can't make it any faster. And so that's normally what I'll do. And sometimes I get to that point and, like, the game just isn't interesting enough. And so I don't post about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, like, a lot of, like, ideas that you started that just didn't go anywhere?
Not that many. Like, I'd say like more often than not I finish what I start, but
that's great.
I think it's like close, you know, it's probably like 60-40 or something.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a much better ratio than anybody I've ever met in my entire lifetime.
Wow, mm-hmm.
I was going to say, though, Adam, you can't get away from the reverse question, though, because Nolan wanted to hear your answer, and I want to hear your answer, too. So
yeah, I'm also, I'm curious. I know, like, you've both done, like, Game Jam. Like, I remember you placed really well at a Ludum Dare a while ago, and then you also have these really long-running running things.
Yeah, I mean, I am such a, like, a boring case of a gamer, because, like, I literally just have that, the exact story everybody else has of, like, you know, I grew up and I had a Super Nintendo and I was obsessed with that. And then I got a PlayStation and I was obsessed with that. And, you know, by the time I was maybe like 11 or 12, I was like, I want to make games. This is what I want to do. So I think I just, for the big game, it's really just me trying to channel the feelings that I got playing like Final Fantasy X into a project and wanting other people to feel that. And so because it's such a conventional shaped thing that I'm making, it's done when it's finished, you know, when I can get to the credits and you can, you know, it's got 20 hours of content and side content and blah, blah, blah. For the smaller games, that I feel like comes a lot more from a more, like I studied design at university. So the idea of like hacking stuff together and prototyping and wanting to explore a concept, that itch gets scratched by the smaller projects. And so, yeah, I feel like they are two very different modes. And I've tried sort of in the middle as well. I had like a couple of 6-month projects. Those can be fun too. I think the tough part is then like when a project needs to become a product and you have to like support it as a piece of software or something like that, it becomes, there's like a threshold there you have to cross over when you release something. And the more time you spend on it, the more it has to sort of justify the time you spent. So yeah, I tend to stick to one end of the spectrum at a time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think like game jams are so nice for the, like, I'm just going to express this one idea. Right. And then like, maybe a lot of people find it compelling and you do something else with that, but like having the freedom to do that without the, like, I worked on this for 6 months and so I feel like I should get something out of it. Yeah. Type of thing. It's really, yeah.
Oh, speaking of, just as a fun aside, our buddy Cakes, we should link it, Prime, in the description of this video. He's a longtime Twitch streamer friend. He just released his tower defense game. He's been working on it at Twitch for like 4 years. We should just give it a shout out. I am giving it a shout out right now. The link will be in the description for other people. This is not an ad. It is just, he's a friend of ours who raids us a lot on Twitch, and I want to make sure we're shouting him out everywhere because he finished a project on stream after 4 years. So it's awesome. So people should go check that out. That just reminded
me. What's up, Cakes?
Yeah. What up, Cakes? Yeah.
And yesterday I was I opened up Steam to play a game that you may have heard of, Slay the Spire 2. And when I opened it up, me and my son are doing a little co-run together.
Oh,
and when
nice.
I opened it up, it said, hey, Tower Defense Mania or something like that. And I was just like, see more. And it said, here's a bunch of games of Tower Defense. And it was like Balloons. And then Tangy was number 6.
Nice. That's sweet.
Hell
so, yeah.
Yes.
Stoked.
So anyways, that was just a quick aside that I wanted to make sure, because I was thinking, oh, we have a friends on who make games. We also have to talk about our other friend who just released a game. So anyways, Adam, the question I was going to ask you, though, was from any of your like smaller projects where you're working on like Game Jam or something else, you take any of those ideas, put them in Insignia? Like, any good examples?
Actually, there was one recently that's not from a game jam at all. We had like an on-stream game we used to play called, well, we call it just Clinkers. It's like it's like a candy in Australia that is covered in chocolate. And there's like three kinds in a packet, but you don't know which you're eating until you eat it, because it's covered in chocolate. So we just use it as like gambling in the stream. So people redeem points and I bite into one and they guess. And if they guess correctly, I put an Easter egg in the game. And we've decided that we're not doing it anymore because I think they're phasing it out, but also like I can't stand the taste of them anymore. Like I like so many of these things over like 6 years now. It's like killing me. So it's in the game now, or at least it will be. We're gonna put like an in-game. It's like a 1 in 3 chance thing. So that happened. There were times when I would do a game jam. Like we've thought about specifically working on like an Insignia in-game mini game through a jam.
Mm-hmm.
certainly, like, yeah, a few different ideas have sort of crept in. Actually, yeah, like, one of the main mechanics in the game came from a jam. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Yeah.
Okay. a game I made called Trauma back in, I think it was 2022 maybe, or 2020, one of those.
I think my therapist told me about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what it's... It's kind of like... It's a platformer where you play as a girl who's in therapy. And the way that you play it is it's a platformer and you get, like, abilities that send you off in different directions in the screen. Mm-hmm. So, like, to clear a jump. Like, she can't jump on her own. She can only move around. And you have to touch these, like, specific, like, trauma points to, like... read about or like to like prompt conversations, and then once they're kind of like little puzzles, and once you solve a puzzle and you kind of like heal the trauma, mm-hmm. You get to like you get like a card, and then you play that card to use the ability. So like at first you walk over a little node and it'll like throw you away, but then like after you've solved the little puzzle, like you'll use that node and the card you get from it to like, this is a jump card, or this card thrusts you forward, or and by the end you get like 6 or 7 cards, and you can chain like a really long jump sequence. Just you're just pressing space to play the cards, but you're starting at one point and sort of like clearing this crazy like Celeste style gap. So yeah, that the ability of like, or like the concept of chaining like directional style mm-hmm. abilities into like one big platforming leap. That's kind of like what Insignia's ability system kind of, yeah, that's how it works. So.
All right, I got something for you, Nolan. My favorite blog that you wrote was the 1 million checkboxes blog. And the reason being is that as you started off with this like really simple concept. I want to send 1 million checkboxes down that people can like look at and click in. It's a very like approachable and consumable idea. You're like, "Okay, I get everything you're about to say." But then you start going, "Okay, well, how do I send the data down?" Okay, like this is actually a really big problem because 1 million of anything is a big number, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just a big number to send down. And so I can't just send down like a JSON map or an array that's encoded in JSON because it's just going to be huge. And so you start kind of going through this process of like working through and sending down the data through binary stuff, through, you know, I forget if it was WebSockets that you sent it down via or whatever it was. And you ended up having to pack everything down into bits, and then you talk about, okay, well, at first my infrastructure was in Python, and then that just was not going well, so I switched to Go, and things went way better for whatever reason. Magic, I guess, the magic
crazy.
Of compiled
yeah,
languages.
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's crazy how compiled languages are just so much better at that kind of stuff. And so I love that process of going from, I'm going to build an idea, to this is actually how an idea can realistically execute. Mm-hmm. How often at this point do you still run into a situation where you've learned as much as you did, say, on 1 million checkboxes? Because now you've seen a lot. You've seen some shit. And so now it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to start off in Python on a single box. I'm going to, you know, you kind of like, you pre-plan for some things to come down.
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, the firefighting like that, right? Like I launch 1 million checkboxes. It's like a single small VM. It's running in Python. It's like, you know, people are going crazy. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of people trying to check boxes. Firefighting like that is just really fun, right? Like you also learn a lot, but like it's super motivating, right? Mm-hmm. Like you learn exactly what you need to do to keep the site up for the next like 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Whereas these days I'm, you know, just thinking a lot more about like, okay, like let's imagine a number of people, like for the snake game, right? I made like a game that you play over RSH. It's like a massively multiplayer snake. For something like that, I'm like, all right, what's a number that's insane? You know, 2,500 people are not going to concurrently play my stupid SSH snake game. So let's make sure that we support that out of the box. And then like I did that and like I could support that. But it might have been more fun to like launch that game without really thinking about performance at all and then seeing what broke. So I think like I don't want to say I don't learn anymore or anything like that. For the chess game that I made last year, I still learned a lot. But it's harder, right? Like in a way I'm prematurely optimizing, right? And it's like hard to say because I am putting things out on the internet. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of scary things, like I don't want like a massive bandwidth bill that I wake up to or something like that. So there are things that like you actually do really have to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I kind of feel like I should be moving a little bit faster, especially since sometimes the things that I'm preparing for just like truly don't matter, or like they are just content, right? Like I think the decisions that I made for the Snake game that I made recently were primarily because I just wanted to learn a lot about how to write a super efficient terminal application, but I had to like make that choice. My users didn't make it for me.
It was it was a very good blog, by the way, the SSH stuff. I really enjoyed how you put together, especially the Unicodes and the vertical movement. Classic first problem of any terminal game.
Yeah.
I thought you were gonna say you really liked how we gave Terminal a shout out. That's what I thought you were gonna say. For that was why you really liked the blog post.
It was a good shout out. It was real.
It is funny though, like, because you would think, you know, from just like, oh, I'm gonna make something that runs in the terminal, you're like, oh, it can't take a lot of bandwidth or it can't take a lot of data. But we ran into this too in some of the early stuff for Terminal Shop, and we ended up not having to fix it to the same extent because it's not like updating as often. It just updates when people take action, so we don't have to redraw.
I think at one point we were sending down like the first hour is like 60 frames a second, no matter who was coming.
The thing that we did initially that made us send an insane amount of data was we had a huge React Miami logo, and it was saying like coming soon. And so you SSH in and it was just like, you know, coming soon, React. But then we had something in there that was like spinning or something that made it so we had to like send a refresh. Or no, you know what
it might have been my coffee, because I did build a particle system.
No, pretty sure we never put that in the application. I actually think it wasn't even, we didn't even redraw it. It was just something with one of the like charm things where we had a timer running somewhere. So it just forced a refresh of like their framework. So it was like counting down the seconds until we said we would release. And so every second it would send down, or like a bunch of times a second, I think the default ticker would send out this huge, I don't know, because we made you have to zoom out to look at it because we wanted the picture to look cool.
Yeah, it was like 1,000 by 2,000 huge.
And then, we took a picture and we did the like picture to ANSI thing.
Yeah.
Right, so we took a physical picture, I'm saying, right? And so it had like a million terminal escape sequences in it, right? Because it was like every character had its own to like make it a different color and make some of them bold.
Slowly going from pink to more pink. Right. Like it was the worst possible case.
So every character had probably like at least, you know, 10 to 15 characters we were sending, right? And then we made you zoom out to be like, oh, we can't show this at, you know, 40 by 80 or something like that. You had to be at like 100 by 800. And then we just were sending that like 60 times a second for no reason. It was a static image.
I just remember that like Dax comes out and is like, guys, we sent like 100 gigabytes in the last hour. And we're just like, how do
also,
we do that?
At that point, we were like, is the whole selling coffee over SSH thing, are we just screwed? We're like, it's like, maybe we can't even build this as an application.
It's the coffee that's the problem.
That's the problem.
I thought for sure the problem with our margins was going to be trying to get good coffee to people and physical products, but it turns out it's just bandwidth. It's just egress costs from our container. We did eventually figure out, when there's a timer running, it resends this. So we fixed that eventually. But I was cracking up about some of it because you just can't even imagine that you're going to have this bandwidth problem over SSH because it seems absurd.
It's
right?
Text. Yeah. It can't be that big.
It's text. Turns out it can be. So I don't know if you want to talk about for people who didn't who haven't yet read the blog post, some of the like fun stuff you did for the Snake game.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite thing that I did was that I like patched the Go SSH library, which I wrote like a whole separate library or whole separate blog post about because this was so wild to me.
Yeah.
But like the gist of that, right, is I'm working on the game, doing all of this profiling because I want the game to be super fast, and I make like a one line change, and so I make this change, and my CPU usage drops by like half. And like at this point, I'm running like I have like a harness with like 500 bots that are connecting, sending moves, and So CPU usage drops by half, and I'm like thrilled, right? Like I'm like, oh man, like this changed, like I've done something awesome. Mm-hmm. So I'm exploring that. I'm trying to figure out like why, because this was not a change that's supposed to make things faster. Like why did that work? And I realized like actually all I had done was I had broken my harness. Like instead of my bots getting data, they just got a single message that said your screen size is too small. I had like broken, cause like SSH, there's like TTYs, like whatever, you know, the details here don't really matter, but yeah. I had broken my testing harness and that's why performance improved, because I wasn't really testing my game. But then I'm like thinking, and I'm like, wait, if my bots weren't receiving any data for my game, why did performance only drop by half?
Right.
Like why did performance not drop by 99%? That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I start capturing packets and like looking at all of that and eventually like see that. If you're just SSH to a box and you press a single key, SSH sends, you know, like about 90 packets. And what's going on there is that there's the SSH is doing something called keystroke obfuscation. The basic idea is that if I see what letter or what keys, sorry, the timing at which you are pressing keys, but nothing else, like all I have is like key press, key press, key press, pause, key press. Well, that pause, maybe that means that you're reaching for like a, you know, the number pad or something like that. Like you're pressing something that's harder for you to get to. Mm-hmm. So SSH just sends junk data all the time to like obfuscate the actual key presses that you're making. But it sends like, if you, the way it works is that it perpetually sends this junk data as long as you, whenever you press like one key.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really bad for games because you're pressing like one key a second. The junk data gets sent for about 1 second. And so it's like one key press turns into 101 packets. And this is not something that you're supposed to be able to disable. Right. I just like, I found the patch and I like read through the SSH code and was like, if I just pretend, if I like claim to the client that I'm just running an old version of SSH that doesn't know about, or SSHD, the you know, server-side component, mm-hmm. that doesn't know about this feature, maybe they won't send these junk packets to me. And that totally works. So I did that. And then I posted about it, and a bunch of nerds got really mad at me because I wrote this whole blog.
Yeah.
And I didn't acknowledge, like, the blog starts out with, like, I am working on a high-performance game over SSH.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, deadpan say that without acknowledging that that's deranged. but it, like, broke containment. Like, it made it to people on, like, Hacker News or Reddit or whatever who don't know the type of stuff that I normally do. So the right comments are just people being like, this, you know, this dumbass vibe coder has no idea what he's doing. Like, yeah. Look how stupid he is.
Yeah, because people are typing in their passwords to very secure boxes over your connection to the Snake game.
Like, I don't even know. I don't know what they were mad at me about.
It's funny because we had the same. We had this problem and we chose to keep it in because we were worried about someone actually somehow finding something you could exploit over that way. But
yeah.
We had a bunch of people complaining too of like, they're harvesting people's public keys, which was the funniest. That was a real complaint.
Oh, I got this launched. Too.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to, what am I going to do?
Your public keys
I know, it was the funniest complaint and like tons of upvotes and people like, this coffee site is a scam from big data to get all of your public keys. And you're like, what am I going to do with only the public key? I don't know. You know, it was like,
do you know what the first word of public key is?
I know. It was like, it was so funny.
We the public.
Yes. Yeah. So similar thing of people getting very upset about this when you're like, I think it's okay, guys. Like it's fine. Yeah. Yeah. Also, it's not like you tried to upstream it back to Go and get them to remove it or so. Like it's, you know.
No, but I did ping. So the Recurse, the place I mentioned earlier, Filippo, one of the Go crypto maintainers, is also a Recurse alum. And so I pinged him on like the Recurse chat to be like, am I like, is this really stupid? Like, am I fired if I do this? And he was like, for your game, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Right.
Thank you, Filippo.
Had the official author's approval. Just reply with a screenshot to all those people getting upset. Like, I've got receipts.
By the way, can I make a quick shout out for your SSH blog? So if you haven't checked it out, you should go check it out. But this was my favorite joke of the entire thing, which is, why does the Snake game render strangely for me? Snakes.run makes use of Unicode block elements. Since these were added in 1991, your terminal may not fully support them yet. For example, Mac OS's terminal app renders them poorly. Try using a different terminal. It's like my favorite thing in the universe is this thing right here. This was
I cannot tell you how many issues I got in NeoVim from people using Terminal app and being like, NeoVim's broken. It can't do colors. And you're like, I don't understand how. And then turns out, oh, this, the default Terminal Mac can't figure out how to update.
No, you can't update it.
It's so bad.
The technology, the private key to the repo was lost, and so they just have the same thing since 1989.
It's so frustrating.
It's actually stuck in 1989. It's old.
Prime, that site that you had up, I just want to note that in keeping with the SSH aesthetic, the whole site uses tables for layout and only HTML that was available in 1995 with no CSS.
Oh,
which
nice.
I was very proud of.
Nice.
That was tables for layout, actually kind of sick. Like, kind of fun.
Tables for
we
layout,
go
actually
back.
Really good. It's actually
yeah,
really
it was
good.
Like, honestly, you know what? Really easy to think about.
You guys heard it here first. It's coming back. After this podcast, you're going to start seeing tables for layout, the Google search trends. Yeah. Big. It's going
up
big.
Frames? Remember frames? Bring those back.
Like iframes?
First off, iframes are all over the place. You go to any news. Okay. Okay.
No,
now,
like,
now you got me. Now you're going to ruin my life, right, and now I'm going to be very upset. You go to any of the news outlets. We're talking about it. Doesn't matter what it is. TechCrunch.
The only news outlet I go to is
Insider,
the Prime Timeogen, okay?
Prime Timeogen. Well, I synthesize this for you. But if you go up on your tabs and you look at, you can highlight and hold something over, and it'll tell you how many megabytes. Like Twitter right here, while having an actual video right here of Doom being loaded and being played, is taking up about 211 megabytes. It says it right there. If you go to any news place, it will be 1.5 gigs every single time. And then you go and you start perusing their code, and it's all just these big videos being pushed into iframes, and it's just insanity going on in the website. Iframes, the devil. I just want to throw that out there. But they're very fun to play with. You could totally do that. I made an entire business.
Iframes game incoming.
On Facebook, the old Facebook apps they used to have way back in the day, I'd load an iframe, do authentication through an iframe and through the URL.
Quick proposal for a game. I don't know what it needs to be, but we need something about iframes, but it's like both the iframe and the internet way, but also the Dark Souls way. Like both. You know what I'm saying? Something about them makes you invincible. I don't know how. I trust Nolan's brain to figure that out in 6 months.
That's inputs good. And outputs right there, Nolan.
That's inputs, outputs. Inputs,
that's
outputs.
Inputs, outputs.
Input, out, iframe. Output, iframe. Think about it.
I had a friend, I don't know what happened to this project, who was working on a thing, because Blue Sky still has a fire hose, right? Like, you can get all of the data from Blue Sky.
Yeah.
And so he had a
very
site.
It's
more than you'd think, right? No, so it was a site that had an individual iframe for every image and every video that anybody posted to the site, like, scrolling, like, as fast as it could. It was, like, actually pretty sick. Like,
yeah.
It was fun to watch.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe it's too scary to put online. Spencer, if you're listening.
There you go. New blog post as well.
Get that up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's definitely something in like the game jam community. I don't know why, but it's kind of like, you know that thing about how everything evolves into crabs? In game jams, there's this thing where guaranteed at least one entry in every game jam is a game where the game is being played across multiple like viewports, like multiple windows or multiple. It's like a platformer, and your character jumps between them. So maybe there's an iframe idea there where you have like multiple iframes, but it's one game being played across them.
Ooh. Oh, draggable iframes to solve puzzles.
That's
something like that.
I was just
with
playing
iframe souls like.
It has to be, yeah. He's cooking.
Still yeah. All right, no, can't cook on stream. You have to think about that one after.
That just reminded me.
You
of
got, yeah, that like hit me. All right.
It hit him.
You just nerd sniped him. You just changed his next 6 months, TJ.
Yeah, sorry, I apologize. I did not mean to do that to you, but I am excited for iframe squared.
I have to ask this for both you two. I know it's a very topical question, and it, you know, this has invaded every part of our life, so I'm actually very, very curious about this. Nolan, we'll start with you, with all of your kind of adventures in doing these little projects, obviously you do but I assume you're doing these for like learning, and they're kind of just like funny, and it's kind of like this in-between ground of learning and just making something ridiculous out of inputs, outputs, as you say. How much do you leverage AI using this kind of stuff? Like, what, where is it fun to continue, or is it just like a no-no, or is it all using it?
It depends a lot. So, like, as an example, I was working on something last week, that was mostly, I don't want to say like fully vibe coded, like that doesn't feel fair. I think I was thinking about it more than that. But resulted in me, like, I made this thing that like puts the bouncing DVD logo over Claude Code when Claude Code is thinking. Mm-hmm. And then I really liked where that was going. Like I liked the kind of power that I had there, but the code was not great. And I wanted to turn that, or am turning that, into like a broader thing that lets me like run arbitrary games on top of arbitrary terminal applications, which I'm really excited about. And so what I ended up doing was rewriting most of that code by hand. I think separately, but kind of similarly, a thing I run into with a lot of stuff is I want to write about it, right? Like I want to explain on my blog how I thought about this, how things worked. And if I'm just kind of like, all right, you know, put the DVD logo inside yourself, make no mistakes, and then like try to blog about that, right? The blog is pretty boring.
I said no mistakes, and then it did it. No mistakes.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And then it made a mistake, and I was like, can you please fix your mistake? Right, like it's just bad. It's bad. And yeah. Some of the fun, right, of all of this is like understanding. So I don't know. I think I use it as a prototyping tool. I use it a lot to write stuff that I already know how to write. And I don't know, probably swapping, kind of using agentic stuff a lot, but also using like cursor tab is still just really good. Like I love writing in VS Code, or writing in cursor by hand, but without boilerplate.
Nice. Not an ad, but could be.
Not an ad. But not an fully ad. Agree with you, too. Cursor
yeah.
tab.
Right, yeah. Like, I think it just, it doesn't change the experience in the same way, right? Like right. It purely removes, it removes stuff that I don't want to deal with right. while still letting me do the thing that I've loved doing for, for my whole life.
Adam, so, Adam, also, yeah. I'd love to hear your side, because I know that I mentioned this on a different podcast, but effectively in 2000, hold on, let me just get up the exact numbers. In 2024, 18% of people at GDC said, hey, we don't really like agentic, or we consider it harmful to the industry. By 2025, it was at 30%. And as of today, as of just the last little bit since last GDC for 2026, it's at 52% say that Gen AI is largely negative for the industry. And so you are kind of in the thick of it, because you're in like the end part of a game. You already have like a lot of established patterns, and so a lot of the conventional wisdom around it all is like, this is a great time to be like, yo, there's this bug, tell me about it. And it's just like, here's the bug right here. Right? Are you using it much in that? Do you find that it's any useful? How does it kind of change in the last couple of years, your development?
This is I could spend the rest of the podcast talking about this. I would say, like, because I started working on the game before there was anything like this. For me, like, there's obviously like the personal, you know, like the fun and the experience of learning how something works and building something. I feel like we all kind of, you know, relate to that. And there's obviously the fear that that will go away if the computer is doing more than you're doing less. And so there's just less of you. There's just less reason to be interested, or less. Yeah, it's just like less. The more gaps get filled by the AI. I do use it. Like I don't really vibe code. I feel like my code base for Insignia, it's not compatible. Like there's so much logic in there that's written by me that I'm not really asking it to do anything boilerplate or like, you know, simple anymore. It's like, okay, I'm trying to thread these two things together. I do tab a lot. Like if it's just something that's helping me get where I'm going with fewer keystrokes, then it's fine. But I need to know. I need to basically mentally sign off on every line. And maybe I've thought, like, is this just a control thing? But no, I really do think, like, it's better for everyone if there's a human who understands how everything works. In terms of, like, the game industry and how that affects it, I mean, I think the game industry has already got a problem with quantity versus quality. And so I think the biggest fear is that the sea of like just slop that makes it hard to curate games that people have really put a lot of energy into or that are worth people's attention is just, it just becomes harder to curate when there's just more and more stuff. And I guess as with a lot of industries, like AI has this quality of being insanely powerful, but also at the same time, the people who it can most appeal to are people who aren't qualified to make like good designs. Like they're just entry level trying to get in, and the fact that the concept of something being able to do all the hard stuff for you is really appealing to people who can't write it themselves. So what kinds of games are they going to make? That's kind of the fear, I guess.
It's an interesting idea that because it is, if you're releasing an indie game on Steam, like I remember when Tangy TD, speaking of that, when he released, one of the first comments I saw in his chat was, dude, I can't believe you released it right after Slay of the Spire. And so there's already like this whole thing where people talk about like, oh, release collision. You're totally screwing yourself if you release right next to some other big title and all this. And so I can imagine that if the amount of releases increases by 100x, it doesn't matter if your game is like several standard deviations more fun than everybody else. You have an entire like sea now to kind of swim through, as opposed to just like, oh, there's a few releases today.
There's also, I think, a reason that people in games are more opposed on average to AI is that a lot of people that aren't software developers do stuff in games, right? And I think that like Gen AI for people that are artists is probably on average more threatening, right? Like if there are a lot of people that need a lot of art assets for, there are a lot of people who don't care really what the assets look like, right? Mm-hmm. That want an asset for like, they're writing a blog and they want a little header image, right? And now they're never going to pay, or a lot of those people aren't going to pay someone to do that.
Right.
Right. And that is taking work away from people that maybe make really beautiful art and then also make a living partially kind of making these things for people that, mm-hmm. that are less likely on average to pay them. So I don't know. When I've talked to people in the games industry, I feel like there's an awareness of kind of the broader whatever stuff that Gen AI is doing, whereas a lot of this, you know, like tech Twitter discussion is very focused on coding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely this like, I try to come at it from different sort of like ethical perspectives. Like you can, it's very easy to say like, you know, AI took our jobs kind of thing. And I think there's an argument that someone could make to say, well, those jobs don't deserve to exist anymore, and they'll just be some other job that people will do instead. That, I mean, I don't mind if people are sympathetic or not to that, but it's definitely a thing. Like I'm you know, budgeting next parts of my game. I've got, you know, people who work with me who I pay and they produce assets. And if I just do the plain, you know, economic what's cheaper and what can I get away with, yeah, I could easily like, at least if not today, a year from now, probably cancel out a lot of that stuff. You know, we were talking about Suno before. You could probably make a game soundtrack in Suno. So, I mean, it kind of just like, as an industry, as a community of people, like, it's nice if we get to stay here. It's mm-hmm. it's cool if we all have jobs and get to do stuff still. And then I guess there's also the asset side of games, because there just seems to be a different sense where code is not as expressive, maybe, or it's kind of more like, it feels like mathematics, where it's like, you know, you discover maths, you don't like own maths or create maths. So in the same sort of sense, you kind of like a solution for how to sort a list is not something anyone feels any ownership of, but, you know, a character, a face that somebody drew, that's like their drawing. They feel like they own it. And so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, like all AI that generates assets has to have been taken from like a thing that a person drew.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something there that just feels a bit ickier as well.
I definitely feel that, where I feel pretty okay using whatever agentic coding tools, but feel much less comfortable with kind of the broader whatever generating asset stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's also a thing, like Prime, you had a good post recently, right, where you said, like, I'm sick of getting everything I ask for and nothing that I want, right? That was the quote.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people liked, resonated with a lot of people. And I've thought about that a lot when it comes to kind of game stuff, where I think, like, sometimes, you know, in whatever the broader software world, you're just kind of making a tool and it needs to do a thing, and like the details here don't necessarily matter that much. But if I'm like making a game, I want to make a lot of the decisions myself. And it's really easy if a tool makes something for you for it to make decisions without you realizing that it made a decision at all, right? Like mm-hmm. you're just kind of like, oh, that's obviously what it looks like because the tool made it.
Right.
Whereas if you had done it yourself, you might have whatever, consider different approaches. And I think the more you're trying to make something that's like fun, compelling, artistic, interesting, the more being aware of those decisions matters.
Yeah, process is the whole thing for a lot of it. And I'm sure all of your experiments, you know, there are things that you learned or things that you did because of constraints that came up in the process of you making it. And if you, like you said, if you just asked the AI to do something and then it did it and that was your blog post, it wouldn't be very interesting.
Well, I've typed make it fun, so it's kind of different, you know. Yeah. Like, that's what's unique about my games is I typed make it fun. So
you guys just don't know how to prompt. You have prompt skill issues, honestly.
And speedrunnable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and speedrunnable. Yes, exactly. Well, maybe what we should do, though, is it would be fun to have maybe even both of you back on. We could talk about this for a little bit longer. I didn't know you were going to have so many opinions about it. I think we should have a longer discussion about it. Would be a good time.
I'd actually like to know more about the game, just the game side, because I do find it. I made this post somewhere, and it actually was one of my few, like, I'd call more viral kind of like shorts. And it's just like, I don't really understand it, because as a programmer, I guess I've grown up around this notion that you go on GitHub, you go grab some code, you bring it in your project, almost everything's MIT licensed. You don't really think a lot about attribution. Every now and then your lawyers go over and say, hey, you can't use these libraries. And you go, okay, I would never use these libraries anyways, bada bing, bada boom. Like,
yeah, of course, that's
been my big corporate kind of... I even remember specifically at my previous job, we actually had a big discussion about can we legally use React, because at first there was like this kind of weird legal language saying that React, if you use React, they actually own your software. This was before a big license change over at the React thing, and so there's a lot of discussion of can we even build with React, this is very dangerous. And so I just have always just had this mentality like, oh yeah, you just take it. And so when Gen AI came out, I just never even once thought about this process of like, oh yeah, that wouldn't be good. Like, that never really crossed my head during the first initial part, because I didn't, all shallows are clear. I did not think about it very deeply. I just was like, oh yeah, of course. I go on GitHub all the time and take code. This is no problem. I just go to Stack Overflow, blah, bing. Now I'm just like, here's new Stack Overflow. And then as you start thinking about it, you go, oh, this is a little bit different. And then designers just feel so much different. And this is like that meme that exists where it's just like, hey, I took your code. Cool, I took it from somebody else. Hey, I took your design. I hate you, and I'm going to kill you. it's like vastly different experiences.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And so I'm just so curious about that whole side, because I just have no, like, I have no experience on that side. Casey is effectively my version of trying to learn about it.
Yeah. Well, okay. So then, people in the comments, leave a comment if we should do that, because I think it would be fun. I have to leave right now. I'm already late for dinner with my grandparents. I'm going to be in big trouble otherwise. So, okay, I have to leave this very moment. Okay, bye, everyone. That's the end of Stand Up.
The name is TJ, Nolan, Adam. If you want more, please let us know in the comment. Thank you very much for joining us for the Stand Up.
Boot up the day. Vibe coding. Errors on my screen. Terminal coffee. And hands.